The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, I'm Linda Poon, and I'm speaking with David Grimm, online news editor for Science, about some of the recent stories from our online daily news site. So Dave, in our first story, how ultramarathons may actually be easy on the body. Science reveals that ultramarathons actually cause less damage than running shorter races. So first question, what makes a marathon an ultramarathon?
Well, Linda, if you really want to know what makes an ultramarathon, you'd probably want to look to the Tour du Géant in France, if I'm saying that right, and it may not be. My French isn't very great. This is a pretty extreme race. The participants walk and or run for about 330 kilometers in the Italian Alps. They're dealing with an increase in altitude of 24,000 meters, a time limit of 150 hours, and no required stops, which means that people run this race often without sleeping or sleeping very little. It's very extreme, very intense on the body. And the question with the study is, do the people that run these kinds of races actually do more damage to their bodies than people that run races that aren't so extreme? And the surprising answer is that they actually may be doing less damage to their body.
So when they're looking at these runners, what are they looking for?
They're looking for things like how fatigued these people are after the race. They also look at blood samples. They look for the presence of certain chemicals that can show stresses on the body, enzymes that are released in response to tissue damage, things like that.
All right, so you mentioned a sleep deprivation factor. So how did researchers account for that?
Well, what the researchers did is they actually looked at 15 runners that had run this race in 2011. And, you know, they wanted to know, because a lot of them don't sleep that well during the race, they actually compared them to a group of 8 trained runners who were limited to a similar amount of sleep, which could be as little as an hour and a half by the midpoint of the race and 9 hours by the end of the race. So they had people running the race, people that weren't running the race but weren't sleeping very well. And they also compared this to people that had run races that were maybe about half of the length of the Tour du Géant, just to see what the various impacts of these different routines were.
So how do these runners compare to others when it comes to muscle fatigue?
Well, what they found, which was really interesting, is that the runners that had run this really long French race showed less muscle fatigue. They had lower levels of inflammation in their blood than the runners that had run a race that was about half as long. They also had lower levels of creatine kinase, which is an enzyme released by muscles in response to tissue damage.
And what does sleep deprivation actually force competitors to do? Does it actually help them in this case then?
Well, that was the interesting thing. The researchers were trying to figure out, you know, what is it about running this really extreme race that seems to actually make people better off? And some of it appears to be the sleep deprivation. Actually going for long amounts of time without sleeping forced the runners to pace themselves more. It also forced them to move a lot slower, especially when they were really tired. And actually that seemed to take a lesser toll on the body than people that slept longer during races or that ran shorter races.
So does that mean we should make marathons longer to make them safer?
Well, I'm not going to be running this race anytime soon, but it does suggest that the body finds ways to compensate for these very extreme events. And in some cases, this compensation can actually protect the body.
Interesting. Well, in our next story, how gut bugs explain the link between obesity and cancer. So what do gut microbiota have to do with cancer?
Well, that's a good question. Turns out the microbes that live in our gut are responsible for a lot of diseases. Our gut microbes have been linked to inflammatory bowel disease, allergies, even heart disease. So perhaps it's no surprise that they may also be linked to cancer. The question in this study is, do they help explain this link between obesity and cancer? We know that people that are more obese or more prone to certain types of cancer, but scientists don't really understand the mechanism behind that.
So what did they do to study this?
Well, what they did was they studied this in mice, and they had mice that were lean and they grew up on a normal diet, and they had other mice that grew up on a very calorie-rich diet and became fat. And they exposed both of these groups of rodents to a cancer-causing chemical shortly after birth. And what they found is, similar to humans, only about 5% of the lean mice developed cancer, but all of the obese mice developed cancer. And when they looked a little further, they found that these mice actually had different compositions of microbes in their guts. The obese mice also had higher levels of a compound known as deoxycholic acid, or DCA, which is a byproduct left over after certain microbes break down bile acids produced by the liver. Now, it's known in humans that DCA can cause cancer by damaging DNA, so it was really interesting that they were finding these higher levels in the obese mice.
So how does diet play a role in cancer development?
Well, that was one of the questions the researchers had, you know, is it diet-based? But they found when they looked at another group of mice that were genetically engineered to become obese, regardless of the diet that they were fed, these mice also had higher levels of DCA, which suggests that it's the gut microbes themselves that are playing a role in the cancer rather than just the diet that these animals are eating.
So what does this mean for the future of cancer prevention in humans?
Well, it suggests that one way to go after cancer might be actually going after our gut microbes. And what was really interesting in the study is when they gave these obese mice an antibiotic, the animals showed a reduction in their cancer incidence. And also when they reduced their DCA levels, these mice also had a lower risk of cancer, which suggests that both of these are possible pathways for treating cancer in humans.
Finally, we go back in time and look at the sequenced genome of a 700,000-year-old horse. So, Dave, why is this a landmark study?
Well, Linda, it's a landmark because this is the oldest organism that's ever been sequenced. Before this, there was a fossil that was about 130,000 years old. This was from a polar bear jawbone that researchers were actually able to get DNA from. But this obviously is several hundred thousand years older. It's from a horse. It's from a bone that was found in Canada's Yukon Territory. Scientists were exploring a site that holds ice and volcanic ash that date back about 700,000 years. So they knew when they found this bone, it was very old, but they didn't think they could get DNA from it just because it's been really hard to get DNA from anything that old. And actually, some studies suggest that DNA doesn't even hang around for more than a million years. So scientists always sort of assumed that if they found something that old, that the DNA would be long gone.
So what does its DNA indicate?
Well, there's been some controversy in the study of equine evolution, and equines include horses, donkeys, and zebras, about exactly when they evolved, how related they are to each other. And also, there's been some mystery surrounding a horse known as the Tsarolski horse, which is considered the world's only remaining wild horse. There's been a source of controversy about this horse, about whether it's actually been mixed a little bit with domestic horses or about whether it is truly completely wild. And what the DNA revealed is that this horse seemed to share a common ancestor with the rest of the equus lineage, and that includes all donkeys, horses, and zebras. This common ancestor likely lived around 4 to 4.5 million years ago, which really starts to shed some light about when all these animals came into existence. But the DNA also suggests that the Tsarolski's horse is genetically distinct from all these other animals, and it did not mix with the domestic horse, suggesting this is a very unique animal.
So 700,000 years is a very long time. How is the ancient horse any different from today's modern ones?
Well, the scientists say this horse, and he was a he based on the DNA, was large but not as tightly muscled as a modern horse, maybe looking a little similar to today's Arabian horse.
And this technique is obviously very advanced. What other things can we learn from this new technique?
Well, the great thing about this, the really cool thing, is that they were able to sequence something that old, which suggests that other fossils that are found that old, we could potentially recover the DNA from them as well, and that could shed light not just on horse evolution, but potentially human evolution and the evolution of a whole host of other animals.
Well, these are three very interesting stories. What else do we have on the site this week?
Well, Linda, for Science Now, we've got a story about why whale veins don't collapse in the very deep depths that whales dive. Also, a story about the similarities between our brains and the brains of honeybees. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a number of stories on the site this week, including a story about the first clinical trial with induced pluripotent stem cells and what implications that could have for human disease. For Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week our Science Live is about human cloning, the ethical and scientific issues related to that. And then we'll be taking a bit of hiatus for a couple months, and Science Live will return in September. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks so much, Dave.
Thanks, Linda.
David Grimm is the editor for Science's online daily news site. You can check out the latest news in the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.